Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Radio games. You still bring me to places. Sunny seaside car parks where the grass was as hot as the sand. To an army of hard-working fathers fulfilling Sunday obligations when holidays lasted only one day. Twisting wire coat hangers into a variety of antenna, no two the same. A steel grey sea of reception, so that your lyrical tone would not be broken, and the inexplicable marvel that was radio waves could travel from Dublin to the wing of a Morris 1100 uninterrupted. Marriage vows put to the test with pleas of try it now, an 89.6, not the whole way to 90. Car doors wide open like a mighty flock of multicoloured guillemots about to take flight. The occupiers blessed with your gift of bilocation. And how they flew. A murmuration of Fiats and Fords, swooping along sidelines, sailing between uprights, twitching uncontrollably on the hot leather seats, half standing, half sitting, involuntarily grasping at slitters travelling at ferocious speed. The marriage vows again strained with rolling eyes and where's the flask? Work-weary bodies at breaking point, being in two places at the one time.
So it's 2:13 to 2:11. What a finish is in store for us with 4.5 minutes left in the game. It's 2:13 to 2:11. Limerick have had more of the play than the Offaly men, but Offaly, they have the breeze behind them. The sun comes out. Possession from this puck out will be really, really crucial and vital. Ger Hegarty reaching up and come down with that ball, but losing it to Johnny Pilkington. Pilkington of Offaly sends it away down the field. I'm trying to get inside now. Pat O'Connor. Another goal for Offaly by Pat O'Connor. Another goal.
Whenever I hear the buck-buck-gawking of chickens, no matter where in the world I am, I'm transported in memory to the yard of my mother's home place, where I lived for 2 years until I was 5. Then other memories arrive, of walking through the garden of blackcurrant bushes beside the house, bushes which seemed enormous to me at the time, of my grandfather and my uncle Jack cutting timber for firewood on the other side of the lane with a two-man cross-cut saw. Of being brought by my Aunt Julia by the hand to pick nettles for nettle soup. I have memory neither of picking the nettles nor of eating the soup, only of being told by her that that's what we were off to do. One or other of the adults would light the tilly lamps in the evening, and it wasn't until I moved to a modern house coming up to my 6th birthday that I realised that switching on an electric light was not a facility they possessed. Aunt Julia baked both brown and white soda bread every day in a big black pot that hung down from the chimney over a fire of turf and wood that never went out. It was allowed to go down to its lowest when everyone had gone to bed and was revived the next morning by the simple expedient of adding more fuel. They milked a single cow, and Julia kept 2 goats that I realised, even at that young age, were her special responsibility. My mother told me later that the thatched roof on the house kept it warm in winter and yet cool in summer. These memories come from the early 1950s. The location was the townland of Cooleyshelmore, 3 castles near Freshford in North Kilkenny, and that grandfather of mine was Jim Lawler, a famous Kilkenny hurler in the early 20th century. The area of 3 castles is a hurling stronghold to this day and includes Tullerone, the most successful club in the history of Kilkenny senior hurling. A notable feature of my grandfather's game was reported to have been his speed. He was regarded as one of the fastest sprinters ever to hurl in his day. Although he's also credited with the remark that it's not much use making it to the ball first if you can't hold on to it or do something with it. The 1911 census records that he was a bootmaker, but I only remember him making slithers, the cork cord waxed twine rolled balls finished with a leather outer sphere in two figure of eight halves that would have been stitched together by, yes, someone with leather worker training and used in hurling matches. They were known in those years as the Lawler Ball. I have other memories of him filling and tamping down his pipe as he worked. This seemed to me to take more time than he spent puffing it, but I suppose now this was part of his procedure. And I remember seeing him cycling off to the post office with a carton of slithers on the carrier, perhaps to send to England or even America, and how he'd always return with packets of Smarties for me and my brother. He supplied Kilkenny GAA Central Council and major clubs in the country with hurling balls for more than 45 years. Jim Lawler liked to hunt and fish, and he took a drink. In my time of living in his house, he had two dogs, one of which was named Grouse. We could sometimes hear his shot when he had gone with his gun and his dog onto the hill over the house, and then Julia would remark that she'd have to pick shotgun pellets out of a bird later on. His daughters blamed his propensity for standing in the middle of a river in his waders for long periods of time, for the aches and pains he suffered in his advanced years. He lived into his 80s and, as the bearer of two All-Ireland medals, is still talked about whenever hurling in Three Castles is discussed.
Mention summer 1995, and the first thing most people remember is how long and hot and scorching a summer it was. The second thing, well, if you're from Clare anyway, is how the valiant senior hurling team bridged an 81-year gap to emerge victorious All-Ireland senior hurling champions. In early June that year, the distraction of the Munster hurling semi-final came as welcome respite from study for my exams in food business at UCC. My sole fellow Clare housemate, Margaret, and I watched the game amid a gang of rebels in the sitting room of our student accommodation on Western Road. Clare trailed Cork as the game edged towards conclusion. Shawnee McMahon, very obviously injured, had switched to unfamiliar forward territory. He hurried for and won a line ball for Clare. We banner girls watched in delight and a bit of disbelief as Fergie Toohey cut the ball in and Ollie Baker deftly flicked the schlitter into the net to score the winning goal. It was a rare opportunity to gloat over our Corkonian chums. With my exams completed, I made plans to get summer work in Glasgow. Easier than continental Europe, where others were going, I figured, as I wouldn't have the challenge of trying to understand a foreign language. How wrong I was. It was difficult in the beginning to understand the lingo, and harder still to make myself understood. Still, I managed to get a job as a breakfast chef in the Copthorne Hotel in Glasgow city centre. This involved six early morning starts a week. Three of these mornings I worked with a chef called Jim, a lanky, grey-haired man of about 60, and the other three I was commie to a chef named Robert, in his 50s, moustached and stocky. He came across as a bit dour, but perhaps he was not a morning person. He was always courteous and we worked well together. On July 9th, I headed with some friends to Edinburgh to see the sights. Two of my companions that day were Limerick men. As we were coming down the steps of Edinburgh Castle in glorious July sunshine, Eamon from Brewery relayed to me, courtesy of his Walkman radio, that Clare had just been crowned Munster Senior Hurling Champions, defeating Limerick in the final. Anthony Daly's war cry that day proclaimed that Clare were no longer the whipping boys of Munster. I learnt many things that hot summer of 95. As breakfast chef, it was my job to stand at the station in the centre of the restaurant and fry the eggs on request. And I learned that Japanese people adore fried eggs for breakfast. This gave me a few hectic mornings as we had busloads of Japanese tourists stay at the hotel. I acquired the knowledge that all Glaswegian men are pals and all the women hens. I found out that the sectarian divide in the city was still strong in places. In the pub after work one evening, one of my workmates, his inhibitions liberated after a few drinks, said to me, "So, are you a Catholic or a Protestant?" "Catholic," I responded somewhat nervously. "Aye," he said, "you never meet a Southern Proddy." "Oh, really? I thought to invite him to East Clare to meet a few of my pals." And I learnt that back home, Dalcassian hurling warriors and their chieftain would capture the minds and the moods of a county and a country. Clare overcame Galway in the semi-final. It was mid-August and the scramble for tickets was on the rise in County Clare. I tried to relay the full wonder of this moment to my Scottish friends. "Clare made the final," I kept telling them, but they failed to see how somebody could get so animated about a game of shinty, as they called it. The day of the All-Ireland dawned. I was on my early shift at the hotel, with my tourist clientele satisfied on bellyfuls of fried eggs, tatty cakes and lorn sausage. I planned to finish and head to the Irish pub around the corner from the Copthorne to fulfil my appetite for a great game of hurling. It transpired, however, that it was an Irish pub in name only, as they chose, to my dismay, not to show the hurling match. Instead, the highlights of an American football game were on offer. I quickly recalculated, rushed back to the flat where I was staying on Old Rutherglen Road and furiously twiddled the long wave dial until I tuned into RTE Radio 1. I sat by myself in a flat in Glasgow and listened intently as the game unfolded. I jumped up, slumped down, groaned with anguish and whooped with joy until the final whistle blew. Then I found myself on my own, elated and absolutely incredulous that these titans of men had done exactly what their leader, Ger Lochnan, had professed they would. Clare had beaten Offaly to become All-Ireland Champions 1995. Later that evening, I was socialising with some Scottish friends. One of them, Chris, turned to me and said, "Oh, by the way, did your pal Clare win her match?" "She did, Chris. She most certainly did."
In the year of 95, in the middle of July, all Munster suffered sunstroke and the grass was all burnt dry. But the drought at the last was ended by 15 warriors brave and bold, when the green and white were brought to ground by the banners blue and gold.
I first met Christy Ring when I was 11. We'd won the Under 12 Street League final and we were to go along to the Glen Hall to receive our trophies. It shows how poor a hurler I was when I was placed 19th in the waiting queue. One by one, my teammates went up. At last, my turn came and, with legs like jelly, I walked up the aisle, head down, hair over my face. as the great man shook my hand, two things stood out. First, his massive wrists. Second, he had the most unusual steel blue eyes which seemed to have a built-in twinkle. I'll never forget what he said to me. Keep your eye on the ball even when it's in the referee's pocket. He presented me with my trophy. That night, I floated home. Not alone was Christy Ring the most charismatic player of all time at his chosen sport, but for a quarter of a century, he was outstanding when the standard was at an extraordinary high level. He played with fire in his veins and a pride and passion in his performance. At the age of 16, I cycled from Cork up to Limerick just to see him play. He was reputed to double the attendance wherever he played. He was the only player in the world I'd pay money to see training. He tried the impossible. What other player would practice cutting the ball over the bar from behind the corner flag? In the 1950s, it seemed to be an annual pilgrimage to Limerick to watch Cork do battle with Tipperary in the Munster final. Tipperary's full backline, Byrne, Maher and Carey, had an awesome reputation. And with Tony Redden behind him in goal, they were like the Rock of Cashel. Nothing passed. When Cork did score, I can still see the slitter sailing over the bar while the Tip defenders wrapped their hurleys around their unfortunate opponents' necks. Then there was that colossus, John Doyle. It must have been like going through the Berlin Wall to find yourself being flattened by a Russian tank. Even Roy of the Rovers would have had his hands full, yet Ringy got many great goals in those games. There were six titanic struggles fought out with an intense fervour, and the victors went on to win the All-Ireland title each time. But will there ever be a more dramatic Munster final than that of 1956 when Cork played Limerick? I was a shy, sensitive garçon listening in my aunt's kitchen in Dublin. With 10 minutes remaining, Cork were being thrashed by Limerick, and that fine hurler, Donald Broderick, was playing a blinder on Ring. Radio Éireann decided to switch over to the Ulster football decider. What a mistake. With despair in my heart, I sat down and waited for the result. Limerick 3-5, Cork 5-5. I jumped up, and in my excitement, I knocked cups and saucers all over the place. My aunt picked up a frying pan and gave me a box across the back. But in my euphoria, I didn't feel a thing. Ringy had the actor's instinct for dramatic timing, and his 3 goals in 5 minutes in that eventful game were pure genius. In hindsight, Limerick didn't stand a chance. Come September, and those giants from Wexford stood between Ring and his 9th All-Ireland medal. Memories from that thrilling game will stay with me forever. Ring's great tussle with Willie Rackard, his solo run and point, followed by a goal which electrified the crowd of 83,000. At Foley's late important save, which got better and better in memory as the years rolled by. I was quite near it, and on the day, I thought it was a very ordinary save. I can still see Ringy charging in on the goalkeeper and the apprehensive Art Foley hopping up and down on his goal line. But the great man just shook his hand, and when the final whistle blew, in a lovely gesture of sporting reciprocation, the Wexford backs shouldered him like a king from Croke Park. Sadly, as Cork was to go through a barren 10-year patch after that, it was his last All-Ireland. My children mock me when I polish my little silver egg cup which I received from Christy Ring all those years ago in the Glen Hall. I ignored them because that night I met my God.
Galavi Chaum an Ima. I'll read the English version first, The Yellow of the Buttercup. When we were young, the angels used to fly among the daisies. The mermaids used to hide in the waves, and sometimes we'd see a sailor boy winking from the rigging. We'd put the buttercup under our chins to see if we liked butter, and we'd see if the reflected yellow circle was there on our skin, and that would reveal the truth to us. Let me see that, our grandfather used to say to us, pretending he didn't believe us saying that we liked butter, his grandchildren who were under his care. Lift up your chin until I see for myself. We used to play soldiers with the plantain, pulling the strongest from the ditch, six in one fistful, and we'd use the best stalk against everyone else, and we'd smack all the other stalks with glee until we'd broken their necks with a brilliant slash, and you'd see the stem collapsed, broken, vanquished, and that would be your victory, and we'd go home then, down the chapel hill to our grandmother at the foot of the cockle path and the geranium beds. And Anish and Lagan Ingoiling, Galavi Chaum an Ima. Nuravia Morog, det liach na hangele mask na nonini, viach na maid na chamara ivalax na tantracha. Agasurnta, decimish, marnelach og e kayachasul sa choltuk. Dardimish Chaum an Ima feinar smigana feachander hahan aimling. Agas decimish, skal an churkel vion erar graken. Aléiríocht dúing an íringe. Lig dom é sinne e ceála derach ar sean ahar ling, ag ligant ar nár cred sé sin rág ar hahan aim ling, a gar fáistí a bhí fin a chóram. Ordig da smig go bheith ceói me é. Dim rímis saidúri le slán lusana ag tarint na blándaí baláidra onglí, sé chéin an éan slám aháin, Churmis an fochanín a bear a gwyna gachainia ele, agus vímis ag smalca a chéle le glunder, go dígam rishimis mwyn eil an ohnín le bwila ontach, agus kifa an fochanín slán lusa awan íslehe, kromha, agus veach an bua ag an dina ele, agus hémis a walia an son, si is cnoch an tepeil cuig ar sean a váhar, ag bon chosán na rochan agus na lapacha geranium í.
From the Fog, for Micheála Mór Hertig. I was on the road to the beach in Dúnshin a year ago, to Paul na Boyd, Cúis na Gopal, agus an Cúisín Gal. And you and your wife, surprisingly all in white, white shirt, white trousers and white dress, emerged elegant from the sheer white morning fog. Cinematic, almost ceremonial. Of course, you were friendly, kind as ever, genial and relaxed. Such a photo it would have been, though. And I had my camera with me, but I was shy of making you uncomfortable in the magic moment. Today, it's in the news that you're gone. And it's so sad you won't come down again to visit the spectral fields of home.
Sunday mornings meant only one thing for our family, the O'Murrahertigs, and that was matches. Of course, there was Mass before that, usually first Mass at 8 a.m., so we could get on the road early to McHale Park, Castlebar, or Páirc Uí Chaoimh in Cork, or St Tiernan's Park in Clonus. Father Harris, a tip man, was our parish priest, and if tip hurlers were playing in the Munster hurling final, the Mass would be over in 15 minutes from start to finish. You would be heading towards Wong's Chinese Takeaway on the Nace Jewel carriageway before the altar boys had time to ring the bell for communion. But All-Ireland Final Sunday meant no travelling, which should have meant a lie-in for us at home. But no, Dad would rise even earlier on All-Ireland Final Sunday and come in jumping up and down with excitement to get us up, pulling open the curtains to let the morning in, as he would say. There was a Mass held in the Ceann Áras in Croke Park on All-Ireland Final Sunday for all the staff, Muirs, Green Blazers, and that was the Mass for Dad on All-Ireland Final Day. But of course, All-Ireland Final Weekend didn't just begin on Sunday morning. It also meant a trip to Shelbourne Park the night before, a great place for GA folk travelling up for the weekend to meet up, buy and sell tickets, talk about the match. It was also where Dad would hear grassroots news on who was going well in training. Ger Cunningham is saving Thunderbolts. Or sometimes news that was being kept quiet, like the Kerry footballer Pat McCarthy had a run in with a bull. The bull is not so good. On the way home from Shelbourne Park, Dad would call into a late night news agents to buy the provincial papers, or into Easton's on O'Connell Street earlier on the way to Shelbourne Park if he needed a certain paper to get the official teams, as there was no internet or social media in those days. The homework would start when we got home. He would read all the local coverage about the teams, and then the foolscap for the match would be brought out along with the different coloured biros. I would call out the team solemnly from 1 to 15 as he wrote them down with care alongside other tidbits of information, but he would often just speak about each individual player off the cuff. Full forward number 14, Matt Connor. Number 14, Matt Connor. Club, Walsh Island. Scored 2-9 against Kerry in the All-Ireland semi-final in 1980 off Mick Spillane. Works as a Garda. His father Jim played for Offaly as well, and their cousin Willie Bryan was at midfield for Offaly when they beat Kerry in 72. The second page on the foolscap is where the notes were made on significant facts like how many All-Ireland titles each team had won and what years they won them, as well as information on the managers and referee. There would also be notes to send best wishes to somebody from Galway, say, that was recovering in hospital for some illness or surgery as they listened to the game, as well as requests from the diaspora of Gaels listening to the game in far-flung destinations around the world. It usually meant the world to the patient to hear their name being mentioned live during the heat of battle as they sat in a bed in hospital willing their countrymen on to glory. Getting a mention on the live radio commentary was better than any medication, it seemed. After Mass in the Ceann Áras, Dad would check in with the RTÉ radio technician in the commentary box in the Hogan Stand. The commentary box had the best view in the house, as it was situated above the lower tier of the old Hogan Stand and hanging below the upper tier of the Hogan. Access to the commentary box was along a wooden gangway suspended above the crowd. Of course, people would recognise Dad as he walked down the gangway and call up to him, and Dad would wave down as we hung on to both railings. It was a luxury to have an RTÉ radio technician there to establish a good line to Montrose, where the match would be broadcast worldwide. For the provincial venues, Dad had a silver steel suitcase, which was like something James Bond would have on the back seat of his Aston Martin. He'd take out some wires and plug the suitcase into a phone line as he connected the earphones and the microphone. He would then twist this revolving lever repeatedly, which would make the phone in Montrose ring, and all of a sudden he'd be talking to Ian Carr or Pat O'Donovan or whoever was the radio producer that day. But in Croke Park there was no need for James Bond's silver steel suitcase. The commentary box in Croke Park was quite compact, with separate cubicles for each radio station. The first cubicle contained the stadium announcer and Paddy O'Hara from BBC Northern Ireland. The second cubicle was RTÉ Radio 1, where our radio technician was waiting for us with two spare seats. The seat in the middle for Dad, and my seat as the scorekeeper to his right side. The third cubicle is where Radio na Gaeltachta would broadcast from, which was usually Micheál O'Shea or Sean Bon Branagh, which would mean great laughter agus kaintas gaelgas of us gatrachta. The commentary box had glass windows which could be rolled down, not by electric means, but by releasing a leather strap slowly lowering the glass. Dad would lower the window fully to let the atmosphere in and to make sure his view wasn't restricted. Then it would be time to walk down to the dressing rooms to see the teams coming in and to make sure there were no late changes. Of course, what should have been a 7 or 8 minute walk would take at least double that time, as we would stop and talk to everyone who had all had the same question for Dad. How will the game go today, Micheál? The dressing rooms were like sacred sanctuaries, but Dad was always welcome before every game. He would glean any information that was going about late changes or changes on the subs bench, and then he would start running up the concrete steps, 2 to 3 at a time, to get back to the commentary box to broadcast the news from the dressing room. I remember one such late change being announced after the Cork football manager Billy Morgan told Dad that Larry Tompkins was out of the Munster football final due to sunburnt feet. And so the scene would be set for Dad to begin his commentary of the All-Ireland final. We would stand to attention in the commentary box for our On the Vian, which was quite difficult as the roof was quite low and Dad was over 6 foot tall. And then the excitement would start to build as the teams lined up for the traditional parade around Croke Park, as Dad would start to describe the scene and the atmosphere. And our hearts would start to beat faster as the referee would throw the ball in. On this All-Ireland final morning, the first All-Ireland since 1949 that my father, Micheál Muirchertach, won't be attending, I'm sure that he is sitting somewhere in heaven in a commentary box about to start commentating on this match. Maybe he has Christy Ring from Cork on one side and Biddy Early from Clare on the other, and he might start by saying, Faltirov Galer Gary Park and Croke again you. Well, Ringy, how will the game go today?
On this morning's programme, we heard Radio Games by John Cooney. Chickens, Hurling and A Famous Bootmaker was by Seamus McKenna. Claire, You've Come a Long Way was by Roisin Bugler. Christy Ring, The First Superstar was by Jim McKeown. Gyalavui Chaman Ima, Yellow of the Buttercup, a poem by Catherine Foley. From the Fog, for Micheál Muirchertach was by Gerry O'Byrne. And All-Ireland Sundays with Dad was by Eamon O'Muirchertach. The music was Joe Cooley's Morning Dew and The New Mown Meadows by Kathleen and Kieran, Wildcats of Kilkenny by The Pogues, The Banner Roar by Kieran McDermott, After All by The Frankenwalters, I'll Be Singing was by Sinead O'Connor, and Cuas na Gcapall, a guitar composition also by Gerry O'Byrne. Christy Ring, The First Superstar by the late Jim McKeown, can be found in the current Sunday Miscellany anthology, which is out now and published by New Island Books. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And if you'd like to listen back to this morning's programme, you can go to the website rte.ie/radio1/Sunday Miscellany or find it and other programmes on the RTE radio app.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.